the first to reach the road. Dustfinger had always been proud of his own agility, but the boy was far nimbler, fast as a deer and with legs just as agile. And he was getting better at playing with fire now, too, as fascinated as a boy with a puppy. Silvertongue braked sharply when he saw Dustfinger and Farid in the road. He looked tired, as if he had slept badly for the last few nights. Eleanor was in the car beside him. Where had she sprung from? Hadn't she gone home to her book-lined tomb? And where was Maggie? Silvertongue's face darkened when he saw Dustfinger. As he got out of the car, he was rigid with anger. "Of course! You told them!" he cried, coming toward him. "You told them where we were! Who else? What did Capricorn promise you this time?" "I told who what?" Dustfinger retreated. "I never told anyone anything. Ask the boy." But Silvertongue didn't so much as glance at Farid. The bookworm woman had gotten out too. She stood beside the car looking grim. "The only person who told anyone anything was you," Dustfinger accused him. "You told the old man about me, even though you promised you wouldn't." Silvertongue stopped in his tracks. It was so easy to make him feel guilty. "Better hide the car under the trees there." Dustfinger pointed to the side of the road. "One of Capricorn's men could pass at any time, and they don't like to see strange cars here." Silvertongue turned and looked down the road.
"Surely you don't believe him," cried Eleanor. "Of course he's given you away. Who else could? The man starts telling lies the moment he opens his mouth."
"Buster took Maggie away." Silvertongue sounded hoarse, quite unlike himself, as if when he'd lost his daughter he had lost the sound of his voice, too. "They took Fenolio as well yesterday morning when I went to meet Eleanor at the airport. We've been looking for the wretched village ever since. I had no idea how many deserted villages there are in these hills. It wasn't until we came to the barrier over the road that I felt sure we were on the right track at last." Dustfinger said nothing, but looked up at the sky. A few birds, as black as Capricorn's men, were flying south. He had not seen them bringing the girl in, but then he hadn't spent the whole day watching that accursed village.
"Buster was gone for several days. I thought he must be looking for the two of you," he said. "You're lucky he didn't get hold of you, too."
"Lucky?"
Eleanor was still standing beside the car.
"Tell him to get out of the way," she told Silvertongue, "or I'll run him down myself. He's been hand in glove with those miserable fire-raisers all along."
Silvertongue was still looking at Dustfinger, as if he couldn't decide whether or not to believe him.
"Capricorn's men broke into Eleanor's house," he said at last. "They took all the books from her library into the garden and burned them."
Dustfinger had to admit that for a split second he felt something almost like satisfaction. What had the silly bookworm woman expected? Did she think Capricorn would simply forget her? He shrugged his shoulders and looked at Eleanor, his face unreadable.
"Only to be expected," he said.
"Only to be expected?"
Eleanor's voice almost cracked. Belligerent as a bull terrier, she marched up to him. Farid tried to bar her way, but she pushed him aside so roughly that he fell on the hot asphalt of the road.
"Maybe you can fool the boy with your fire-breathing and your coloured balls, matchstick-eater," she snapped at Dustfinger, "but it won't work with me. There's nothing left of the books in my library but a load of ash. The police were full of admiration for what those villains had done. At least they didn't burn your house down, Signora Loredan. Even your garden is all right except for the scorch mark on the lawn. What do I care for the house? What do I care for the wretched lawn? They burned my most valuable books."
Dustfinger saw the tears in her eyes, although she quickly turned her face aside. And suddenly, something like sympathy did awake in him. Perhaps she was more like him than he'd thought. Her home, too, had consisted of paper and printer's ink. She probably felt as lost as he did in the real world. He didn't let her see his sympathy, of course, but hid it behind a mask of mockery and indifference, just as she hid her despair behind rage.
What did you expect? Capricorn knew where you lived. Anyone could foresee that he'd send his men out when you'd escaped him. He always takes revenge.
Oh, yes, and who told him where I live? You did!
Eleanor swung her arm back with her fist clenched, but Farid caught it. He had grazed his knee on the road.
He didn't give anything away, he cried. Nothing at all. He's only here to steal something.
Eleanor lowered her arm.
So that's it, Silvertongue went up to them. You're here to get hold of the book. That's crazy. Well, how about you? What are you planning to do? Dustfinger looked at him scornfully. You're just going to walk into Capricorn's church and ask for your daughter back, are you?
Silvertongue did not reply.
He won't hand her over, and you know it, Dustfinger went on. She's only the bait, and as soon as you've swallowed it, the pair of you will be Capricorn's prisoners. For the rest of your lives, most likely.
I wanted to call the police,
Eleanor freed her arm crossly from Farid's brown hands, but Mortimer was against it.
Sensible of him. Capricorn would have abandoned Meggie up in the mountains, and you'd never have seen her again.
Silvertongue looked up at the nearby mountains, looming dark behind their foothills.
Wait until I've stolen the book, said Dustfinger. I'm going to creep into the village again tonight. I won't be able to get your daughter out the way I did last time, because Capricorn has trebled the guards. And the whole village is lit up at night now, brighter than a jeweler's shop window. But perhaps I can find out where they're keeping her prisoner. Then you can do what you like with the information, and in return for my trouble, you could try reading me back into the book. What about it?
Dustfinger considered this a very reasonable proposition, but Silvertongue thought it over only briefly before shaking his head.
No, he said. No, I'm sorry. I can't wait any longer. Meggie needs me.
With these words, he turned and went back to the car, but before he could get in, Dustfinger barred his way.
I'm sorry, too, he said, snapping open Buster's knife. You know I don't like these things, but sometimes people have to be protected from their own stupidity. I'm not going to let you stumble into the village like a rabbit into a trap, just for Capricorn to shut you and your magic voice away. It won't help your daughter, and it certainly won't help me.
At Dustfinger's signal, Farid had drawn his knife, too. Dustfinger had bought it for him in the village by the sea. It was a ridiculous little thing, but Farid pressed it into Eleanor's ribs so hard that she grimaced.
"Good God, are you planning to slit me open, you little wretch?"
she snapped at him. The boy jumped, but he did not remove his knife.
"Move the car off the road, Silvertongue," ordered Dustfinger, "and don't get any silly ideas. The boy will keep his knife pressed at your bookworm friend's chest until you're back here with us."
Silvertongue obeyed. Of course. What else could he do? They tied him and Eleanor to the trees just behind the burnt-out cottage, only a few paces from their own makeshift camp. Eleanor scolded even louder than Gwyn when he was pulled out of the backpack by his tail.
"Stop that," Dustfinger told her. "It won't do any of us any good for Capricorn's men to find us here."
That worked. She fell silent at once, as if she had swallowed her tongue. Silvertongue had leaned his head back against the tree trunk and closed his eyes. Farid checked all the knots again carefully. But then Dustfinger beckoned him over.
"I want you to keep watch on these two when I go down to the village tonight," he whispered. "And don't start carrying on about ghosts again. After all, you won't be alone this time."
The boy looked at him with an injured expression, as if Dustfinger had taken his hand and thrust it into the fire.
"But they're tied up," he protested. "So what is there to watch? No one's ever managed to undo my knots. Word of honour, please, I want to go with you. I can be your lookout or distract the guards. I can even get into Capricorn's house. I'm quieter than Gwyn.
But Dustfinger shook his head. No, he said firmly. Tonight, I'm going alone. If I want someone following me wherever I go, I'll get myself a dog. And with that, he left the boy. It was a hot day. The sky above the hills was blue and cloudless, and there were hours yet to pass before darkness fell. Chapter 36 In Capricorn's House. Two narrow metal bunks, one above the other against a whitewashed wall, a cupboard, a table by the window, a chair, an empty shelf with nothing but a candle on it. Maggie had hoped to be able to see the road, or at least the parking area, through the window, but the only view was of the yard below. A couple of Capricorn's maids were bending over the vegetable patch, pulling out weeds, and chickens were pecking around in a wire netting run in one corner. The walls surrounding the kitchen garden were high enough for a prison. Fenolio was sitting on the lower bed, staring gloomily at the dusty floor. The wooden floorboards creaked whenever they stepped on them. Outside the door, Flatnose was protesting to Basta.
You want me to do what? No, find someone else for the job. Damn it. I'd rather go over to the next village, put gas-soaked rags outside someone's door, or hang a dead rooster from the window frame, or run around outside the house with a devil mask on, like Cockerell had to do last month, but I'm not cooling my heels here, just to keep watch on an old man and a little girl. Get one of the lads! They'll be glad to have a change from cleaning cars.
But Basta wasn't open to persuasion.
You'll be relieved after supper, he said.
Then he was gone. Maggie heard his footsteps retreating down the long corridor. There were five doors to pass, then go down the staircase. At the foot of the stairs, turn left for the front door. She had carefully taken note of the way. But how was she to get past Flatnose? She went over to the window again and opened it. Just looking out made her feel dizzy. Nope, she couldn't climb down. She'd break her neck.
Leave the window open, said Fenolio behind her. It's so hot in here, I feel as if I might melt.
Maggie sat down on the bed beside him.
I'm going to run away, she whispered, as soon as it gets dark.
The old man looked at her incredulously, shaking his head very firmly.
Are you mad? It's much too dangerous.
Out in the corridor, Flatnose was still muttering angrily to himself.
I'll say I have to go to the toilet. Maggie was clutching her backpack. Then I'll just run off.
Fenolio took her by the shoulders.
No, he whispered emphatically. No, you won't. We'll think of something. Thinking up ideas is my job, remember?
Maggie tightened her lips.
Yes, all right, she murmured, getting up to go back to the window.
Dusk was already falling outside.
I'm going to try all the same, she thought as Fenolio stretched out with a sigh on the narrow bed behind her. I'm not going to just sit here as bait. I'll run away before they catch Mo, too.
And for the 100th time, as she waited for darkness, she tried to push away the question that kept coming into her head. Where was Mo? Why hadn't he come? Chapter 37 Carelessness. It was still hot when the sun had gone down. There was not a breath of wind in the darkness, and the glowworms were dancing above the dry grass as Dustfinger crept back to Capricorn's village. Two guards were strolling around the parking area, and neither of them was wearing headphones, so Dustfinger took a different route to Capricorn's house this time. The streets at the far end of the village had been so utterly destroyed by the earthquake which drove out the last villagers that Capricorn had not had them rebuilt. These streets were still blocked by the rubble of ruined walls, and it wasn't very safe to walk there. Even after so many years, loose stones might fall. so Capricorn's men avoided that part of the village, where dirty dishes left by its long-ago inhabitants still stood on many tables behind dilapidated front doors. There were no floodlights here, and even the guards seldom came this way. Tumbled heaps of broken tiles and stones stood more than knee-high in the street that Dustfinger chose. They slipped beneath his feet as he clambered over them, and when he listened to the nocturnal sounds again, afraid the noise might have attracted someone's attention, he saw a guard appear among the ruined houses. His mouth was dry with terror as he ducked behind the nearest wall. Swallows' nests clung to it, one above another. The guard was humming as he came closer. Dustfinger knew him. He had been with Capricorn for many years. Basta had recruited him from a village in another country, for Capricorn had not always lived among these hills. There had been other places, remote villages like this one, houses, abandoned farms, even a fortified castle once. But a day had always come when the web of fear, so expertly spun by Capricorn, tore, and the attention of the police was drawn to his men and what they were up to. Eventually, the same thing would happen here. The guard stood still to light a cigarette. Its smoke drifted to Dustfinger's nostrils. Turning his head, he saw a thin white cat perched among the stones. It sat there, perfectly still, its green eyes staring at him. "Shh," he wanted to whisper. "Do I look dangerous?" "No, but that man they will shoot, first you, then me." The green eyes went on staring. The white tail began twitching back and forth. Dustfinger looked at his dusty boots, at a twisted iron bar lying among the stones, anywhere but at the cat. Animals don't like you to look them in the eye. Gwyn bared his sharp teeth whenever Dustfinger looked straight at him. The guard began humming again, the cigarette between his lips. At last, just as Dustfinger was beginning to feel he would be crouching behind this ruined wall for the rest of his life, the guard turned and strolled off. Dustfinger dared not move until the sound of his footsteps had died away. When he straightened up, feeling stiff, the cat raced away, spitting. And he stood there for a long time among the empty houses, waiting for his heartbeat to slow. No other guard crossed his path, and soon he was vaulting over Capricorn's wall. The scent of thyme greeted him, a heavy scent that usually filled the air only by day. But everything seemed to be aromatic this hot night, even the tomato plants and lettuces. Poisonous plants were growing in the bed just outside the house. These the magpie tended herself. Many a dead body in the village had smelled of oleander or henbane. The window of the room where Raisa slept was open, as usual. When Dustfinger imitated Gwyn's angry chattering, a hand waved from the open window, then quickly disappeared. He leaned against the grating over the door and waited. The sky above him was sprinkled with so many stars, there hardly seemed to be any space left for the darkness. "She's sure to have found out something," he thought, "but suppose she tells me Capricorn has locked the book in one of his safes." The door behind the grating opened. It always squealed, as if complaining of being disturbed at night. Dustfinger turned and looked into a strange girl's face. She was young, perhaps 15 or 16 years old, her cheeks still chubby like a child's.
"Where's Raisa?"
Dustfinger clutched the grating.
"What's happened to her?"
The girl seemed to be transfixed by terror. She was staring at him as if she had never seen a scarred face before.
"Did she send you down here?"
Dustfinger wished he could put his hands through the grating and shake this silly little goose.
"Tell me, I don't have all night."
He shouldn't have asked Raisa to help him. He should have gone searching for the book himself. How could he have endangered her?
"Have they shut her up somewhere? Tell me."
The girl looked at something over his shoulders and took a step back. Dustfinger spun around to see whatever she had seen and found himself looking into Buster's face. Dustfinger's mind raced. Why hadn't he heard anything? Buster was notorious for his silent tread, but Flatnose, who was with him, was no master of the art of stalking. And Buster had brought someone else, too. Mortola was standing beside him, so it wasn't just fresh air that she had been enjoying last night. Or had Racer betrayed him to her? The idea hurt.
"I really didn't expect you to venture here again," purred Buster, pushing him against the grating with the flat of his hand.
Dustfinger felt the iron bars pressing into his back. Flatnose was grinning as broadly as a child at Christmas. He always grinned like that when he was allowed to put the fear of death into someone.
"And what have you to do with the lovely Racer?"
Buster snapped his knife open, and Flatnose's smile widened as fear brought out beads of sweat on Dustfinger's forehead.
"I always said so," continued Buster, as he slowly brought the tip of the knife closer to Dustfinger's chest. "The Fire-Eater's in love with Racer, I said. He'd devour her with his eyes if he could, but the others wouldn't believe me. All the same, to think of a lily-livered coward like you venturing here." "Oh, but he's in love," said Flatnose, laughing.
But Buster merely shook his head.
"No, our dirty-fingered friend wouldn't have come here for love. He's far too cold a fish. He's here for the book. Am I right? You're still homesick for those fluttering fairies and stinking trolls."
Almost tenderly, Buster ran the knife across Dustfinger's throat. Dustfinger forgot how to breathe. The trick of it seemed to have escaped him.
"Back to your room," the magpie snapped at the girl behind him. "Why are you still standing around?"
Dustfinger heard the rustle of a dress, and a door closed abruptly. Buster's knife was still at his throat, but just as the man was about to let the tip of it wander a little higher, the magpie seized his arm.
"That's enough," she commanded. "You can stop your little game now, Buster." "That's right. The boss said we were to bring him in uninjured."
Flatnose's voice made clear how little he thought of this order. Buster let the knife wander over Dustfinger's throat one last time. Then, with a swift movement, he snapped it shut again.
"What a shame," said Buster.
Dustfinger felt the man's breath on his own skin. Buster's breath smelled of mint, fresh and sharp. Apparently a girl he'd once wanted to kiss had told him he had bad breath. The girl had regretted it, but ever since then Buster chewed peppermint leaves from morning to night.
"You've always given good sport, Dustfinger," he said as he stepped back, still holding the closed switchblade. "Take him to the church," Mortola ordered. "I'll go and tell Capricorn." "Did you know the boss is very angry with your mute girlfriend?" whispered Flatnose to Dustfinger, as he and Buster dragged him between them. "She was always quite a favourite of his."
For a split second, Dustfinger felt almost happy. Sir Racer hadn't given him away. All the same, he never should have asked her for help. Never. Chapter 38 A Quiet Voice. Meggie did try her plan. As soon as it was dark, she hammered on the door with her fist. Fenolio woke with a start, but before he could stop her, Meggie had called to the guard outside the door that she had to go to the toilet. The man who had relieved Flatnose was a short-legged fellow with jug ears who was amusing himself by swatting moths with a rolled-up newspaper. Over a dozen insects were already smeared on the white wall when he let Meggie out into the corridor.
"I need to go too," cried Fenolio, perhaps intending to dissuade Meggie from carrying out her plan.
But the guard closed the door in his face.
"One at a time," he grunted at the old man, "and if you can't wait, you'll just have to pee out of the window."
Taking his newspaper with him as he escorted Meggie to the lavatory, he killed three more moths and a butterfly that was fluttering helplessly from wall to bare wall. Finally, he pushed a door open, the last door before the staircase to the ground floor. "Just a few more steps," thought Meggie.
I'm sure I can run downstairs faster than he can.
Please, Maggie, you must forget about running away,
Fenolia had kept whispering in her ear.
You'll get lost. There's nothing outside but wild country for miles. Your father would be furious if he knew what you were planning.
Oh, no, he wouldn't, Maggie had thought. But when she was in the little room, which contained nothing but a sink and a bucket, her courage almost failed her. It was so dark outside, so terribly dark, and it was still a long way to the door of Capricorn's house.
I must try, she whispered to herself before she opened the door. I must.
The guard caught up with her on the fifth stair. He carried her back over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes.
Next time, I'll take you to the boss, he said before pushing her back into the room. He'll think up a good punishment for you.
She cried for almost half an hour, while Fenolio sat beside her, staring unhappily into space.
It's all right, he kept murmuring, but nothing was all right, nothing at all.
We don't even have a light in here, she finally sobbed, and they've taken my books away.
At that, Fenolia reached under his pillow and put a flashlight in her lap.
I found it under my mattress, he whispered. With a few books, too. Who would have thought someone would have hidden them there?
Darius, the reader. Maggie could remember how the thin little man had come hurrying up the nave of Capricorn's church with his pile of books. The flashlight must surely be his. How long had Capricorn kept him prisoner in this bare little room?
There was a blanket in the cupboard as well, whispered Fenolio. I put it on the top bunk for you. Can't get up there myself, I'm afraid. When I tried, the whole thing swayed like a ship at sea.
I'd rather sleep in the top bunk anyway, murmured Maggie,
rubbing her sleeve over her face. She didn't want to cry any more. It was no good anyway. Fenolio had put some of Darius's books on the bunk, along with the blanket for her. Maggie carefully laid them out, side by side. They were almost all books for grown-ups, a well-worn thriller, a book about snakes, another about Alexander the Great, the Odyssey. The only books for children were a collection of fairy tales, and Peter Pan, and she had read Peter Pan at least half a dozen times already. Outside, the guard struck out with his newspaper again, and below her, Fenolio tossed and turned restlessly on the narrow bunk. Maggie knew she wouldn't be able to sleep, so there was no point in even trying. Once again, she looked at the strange books. Closed doors, all of them. Which should she open? Behind which of them would she forget all of this? Bastar and Capricorn, Inkheart, herself? Everything. She put aside the thriller and the book about Alexander the Great, hesitated, and picked up the Odyssey. It was a worn little volume. Darius must have liked it very much. He had even underlined some passages, one of them so hard that his pencil had almost gone through the paper. But hard as he tried, he could not save his friends. Undecidedly, Maggie leafed through the worn pages, then closed the book and put it down. Nope. She knew the story well enough to realize that she was almost as afraid of the Greek heroes as she was of Capricorn's men. She wiped a lingering tear away from her cheek and let her hand hover over the other books. Fairy tales. She wasn't particularly fond of fairy tales, but the book looked attractive. The pages rustled as Maggie browsed through them. They were thin as tracing paper, and covered with tiny print. There were wonderful illustrations of dwarves and fairies, and the stories told tales of mighty beings, tall as giants, strong as bears, even immortal. But they were all malignant. The giants ate human beings, the dwarves were greedy for gold, the fairies were malicious and bore a grudge. No. Maggie turned the light on the last book. Peter Pan. The fairy in that book wasn't very nice either, but at least Maggie knew the world awaiting her between its covers very well. Perhaps it was just the thing for such a dark night. An owl screeched outside, but otherwise all was still in Capricorn's village. Fenolio murmured something in his sleep and began to snore. Maggie snuggled down under the scratchy blanket, took Mo's sweater out of her backpack, and put it under her head.
"Please," she whispered as she opened the book, "please get me out of here just for an hour or so. Please take me far, far away."
Outside, the guard muttered something to himself. He was probably bored to death. The floorboards creaked under his tread as he paced up and down outside the locked door.
"Take me away from here," whispered Maggie. "Please take me away from here."
She let her finger run along the lines, over the rough, sandy paper, while her eyes followed the letters to another, colder place in another time, to a house without locked doors and black-jacketed thugs. A moment after the fairy's entrance, the window was blown open, whispered Maggie, hearing the sound of the window creaking as it opened.
Blown open by the breathing of the little stars, and Peter dropped in. He had carried Tinkerbell part of the way, and his hand was still messy with the fairy dust.
Fairies, thought Maggie. I can see why Dustfinger misses the fairies. No, that was not allowed. She mustn't think of Dustfinger, only of Tinkerbell and Peter Pan and Wendy lying in her bed, knowing nothing yet of the strange boy who had flown into her room, dressed in leaves and cobwebs.
Tinkerbell,
he called softly, after making sure that the children were asleep. Tink, where are you? She was in a jug for the moment, and liking it extremely. She had never been in a jug before.
Tinkerbell.
Maggie whispered the name twice. She had always liked the sound of it. You clicked your tongue against your teeth, and then there was the soft B sound slipping out of your lips like a kiss.
Oh, do come out of that jug and tell me, do you know where they put my shadow?
The loveliest tinkle as of golden bells answered him. It is the fairy language. You ordinary children can never hear it, but if you were to hear it, you would know that you had heard it once before.
If I could fly like Tinkerbell, thought Maggie, I could simply climb out on the windowsill and fly away. I wouldn't have to worry about the snakes, and I'd find Mo before he gets here. He must have lost the way. Yes, that must be it. But suppose something had happened to him?
Maggie shook her head, as if to drive away the bad thoughts that had wormed their way in yet again.
Tink said the shadow was in the big box, she whispered. She meant the chest of drawers, and Peter jumped at the drawers, scattering their contents to the ground with both hands.
Maggie stopped. There was something bright in the room. She switched the flashlight off, but the light was still there, 1,000 times brighter than the night lights.
And when it came to rest for a second, whispered Maggie, you saw it was a...
She did not speak the word aloud. She just followed the light with her eyes as it flew around the room, very fast, faster than a glowworm and much larger.
Fenolio!
She couldn't hear any sound from the guard outside the door. Perhaps he'd gone to sleep. Maggie leaned over the side of the bunk until she could touch Fenolio's shoulder.
Fenolio, look!
She shook him until he finally opened his eyes.
Suppose the little creature flew out of the window.
Maggie slid down from the top bunk and shut the window so quickly that she almost caught one of the shimmering wings in it. The fairy, alarmed, whirred away. Maggie thought she heard an indignant chirrup. Fenolio stared at the shining little creature, his eyes heavy with sleep.
"What is it?"
he asked hoarsely.
"A mutated glowworm?"
Maggie went back to the bed without taking her eyes off the fairy, who was darting faster and faster around the little room, like a lost butterfly, up to the ceiling, back to the door, over to the window again. She kept returning to the window. Maggie put the book on Finolio's lap.
Peter Pan.
He looked at the book, then at the fairy, then at the book again.
I didn't mean to do it, whispered Maggie. Really, I didn't.
The fairy kept colliding with the window again and again.
No, Maggie hurried over to her. You mustn't go out. You don't understand.
It was a fairy, no longer than your hand, but still growing.
It was a girl called Tinkerbell, exquisitely gowned in a skeleton leaf.
"Someone's coming."
Fenolio sat up in such a hurry he hit his head on the top bunk. He was right. Out in the corridor, footsteps were approaching. Rapid, firm footsteps. Maggie retreated to the window. What did it mean? It was the middle of the night. Perhaps Moe's arrived, she thought. Moe is here, although she didn't want to feel glad of it. Her heart leapt with joy.
"Hide her," whispered Fenolio. "Quick, hide her."
Maggie looked at him, confused. Of course. The fairy. They mustn't find her. Maggie tried to catch Tinkerbell, but the fairy slipped through her fingers and whirred up to the ceiling, where she hovered like a light made of invisible glass. The footsteps were very close now.
"Call that keeping watch?"
It was Master's voice. Maggie heard a hollow groan. He had probably woken the guard with a kick.
"Unlock that door and get a move on. I don't have forever."
Someone put a key in the lock.
"That's the wrong one, you dozy idiot. Capricorn wants to see the girl, and I'll tell him why he's had to wait so long."
Maggie climbed up on her bed. The bunk swayed alarmingly as she stood on it.
"Tinkerbell," she whispered, "please, come here."
But as she reached out her hand, the fairy flew back to the window, and Buster opened the door.
"Hey, where did that come from?" he asked, standing in the doorway. "It's years since I saw one of those flattery things."
Maggie and Fenolia said nothing. What was there to say?
"You needn't think you can wriggle out of telling me."
Buster took off his jacket and went slowly over to the window, holding the garment in his left hand.
"You stand in the doorway in case it gets away from me," he told the guard, "and if you let it get past you, I'll slice off your ears."
"Leave her alone." Maggie slid hastily down from the bed again, but Buster moved faster. He threw his jacket. Tinkerbell's light disappeared, snuffed out like a candle. There was a faint twitching under the jacket as it fell to the floor. Buster picked it up carefully, holding it together like a sack, went over to Maggie, and stopped in front of her.
"Well, sweetheart, let's hear your story," he said in a menacingly quiet voice. "Where did that fairy come from?"
"I don't know,"
uttered Maggie without looking at him. She
was just suddenly here."
Buster looked at the guard.
"Ever seen anything like a fairy in these parts?" he asked.
The guard raised the newspaper, to which a couple of dusty moth wings were still clinging, and slapped the door frame with it, smiling broadly.
"No, but if I did, I'd know what to do about it," he said. "You're right. Those little creatures are as troublesome as midges. But they're supposed to bring luck."
Buster turned back to Maggie.
"Now then, out with it. Where did she come from? I'm not asking you again."
Maggie couldn't help it. Her eyes strayed to the book that Fenolio had dropped. Buster followed her glance and picked it up.
"Well, fancy that,"
he murmured as he looked at the picture on the cover. The artist had produced a good likeness of Tinkerbell. In real life, she was a little paler and a little smaller than the picture suggested, but of course Buster still recognized her. He whistled softly through his teeth, then held the book close to Maggie's face.
"Don't try telling me the old man read her out of this," he said. "You did it. I'll bet my knife you did it. Did your father teach you how, or have you just inherited the knack from him?" "Well, it comes to the same thing."
He stuck the book in his waistband and grasped Maggie's arm.
"Come along. We're going to tell Capricorn about this. I was really supposed to get you just to meet an old acquaintance, but I'm sure Capricorn will have no objection to hearing such interesting news."
"Has my father come?"
Maggie did not resist as he forced her out of the door. Buster shook his head and looked ironically at her.
"Him? No, he hasn't turned up yet," he said. "Obviously, he thinks more of his own skin than yours. I wouldn't be pleased with him if I were you."
Maggie felt two emotions at once. Disappointment, as sharp as a prickle, and relief.
"I'll admit I'm rather disappointed in him," Buster continued. "I swore he'd come looking for you. But I guess we don't need him any more, right?"
He shook his jacket, and Maggie thought she heard a quiet, desperate tinkling.
"Lock the old man in," Buster told the guard, "and if you're snoring again when I get back, it will be the worse for you."
Then he hauled Maggie down the corridor. Chapter 39 The Punishment for Traitors. Maggie's shadow followed her like an evil spirit as she and Buster crossed the square outside the church. The glaring floodlights made the moon look faded. It was not so bright inside the church. Capricorn's statue looking down on them in the gloom was pale and half swallowed up by the shadows. Between the columns it was as dark as if night had fled there to escape the floodlights. Only the place where Capricorn sat, leaning back in his armchair with a contemptuous expression and wrapped in a silk dressing gown that shimmered like peacock feathers, was illuminated by a single lamp. The magpie stood behind him, appearing little more than a washed-out face above a black dress in the dim light. A fire was burning in one of the braziers at the foot of the steps. The smoke stung Maggie's eyes, and the flickering firelight danced on the red walls and columns as if the whole church were ablaze.
"Hang the rags outside his children's window as a final warning."
Capricorn's voice echoed in Maggie's ears, although he kept it lowered.
"And soak them with gasoline until it's seeping out," he told Cockrell, who was standing at the foot of the steps with two other men. "When that smell reaches the fool's nostrils first thing in the morning, perhaps he'll finally realize my patience is at an end."
Cockrell received the order with a brief nod, turned on his heel, and signalled to the other two to follow him. Their faces were blackened with soot, and each of the three wore a red rooster's feather in his buttonhole.
"Ah, Silvertongue's daughter," growled Cockrell sarcastically as he limped past Maggie. "Well, well, hasn't your father come for you yet? Doesn't seem very keen to see you, does he?"
The other two laughed, and Maggie couldn't help the hot blood rising to her face.
"At last," cried Capricorn as Buster stopped at the foot of the steps with his prisoner. "What kept you so long?"
Something like a smile passed over the magpie's face. She had pushed out her lower lip slightly, giving her thin face a look of great satisfaction which troubled Maggie much more than Capricorn's mother's usual dark looks.
"The guard couldn't find the right key," replied Buster irritably, "and then... well, I had to catch something."
The fairy began moving again as he held up his jacket, and its fabric bulged with her frenzied attempts to struggle free.
"What's that?" Capricorn's voice sounded impatient. "Have you taken to catching bats these days?"
Buster's lips quivered with annoyance, but he bit back his reply, and, without a word, put his hand under the black cloth. Suppressing a curse, he produced the fairy.
"Devil take these flickery little things," he said angrily. "I've forgotten how hard they can bite."
One of Tinkerbell's wings was fluttering frantically. The other was held between Buster's fingers. Maggie couldn't watch. She was terribly ashamed of herself for luring this fragile little creature out of her book. Capricorn looked at the fairy with an expression of distaste.
"Where did that come from? And what kind is it? I never saw one with wings like that before."
Buster took Peter Pan out of his waistband and put the book down on the steps.
"I think it comes out of here," he said. "Look at the picture on the cover. There are more pictures of her inside. And guess who read her out of it?"
He squeezed Tinkerbell so hard that she gulped silently for air while he laid his other hand on Maggie's shoulder. She tried to shake off his fingers, but Buster merely tightened his grip.
"The girl?"
Capricorn sounded incredulous.
Yes, and it seems as though she's as good at it as her father. Look at this fairy.
Buster grabbed Tinkerbell's slender legs and dangled her up in the air.
Seems perfectly all right, doesn't she? She can fly and scold and make tinkling sounds, all the things those stupid fairies do.
Interesting, yes. Very interesting indeed. Capricorn rose from his chair, tightened the belt of his dressing gown, and came down the steps. He stopped beside the book that Buster had put down on them.
"So it runs in the family," he murmured as he bent to pick it up.
Frowning, he looked at the cover.
"Peter Pan," he read.
"Why, that's one of the books my old reader, Darius, particularly liked."
"Yes, now I remember. He once read to me from it. The idea was to lure out one of those pirates, but he failed miserably. He fetched a load of stinking fish and a rusty grappling iron into my bedroom instead. Didn't we punish him by making him eat the fish?"
Buster laughed.
"Yes, but he was even more upset that you had his books taken away. He must have hidden this one."
"So he must have." Capricorn went over to Maggie, looking thoughtful. She would have liked to bite his fingers when he put his hand under her chin, turning her face so that she had to look straight into his lifeless eyes.
"See how she looks at me, Buster," he remarked mockingly, "just as obstinate as her father always was. Better save that look for him, sweetheart. You're very angry with your father, I'm sure, but I couldn't care less where he is. Because from now on I have you, my new, my wonderfully talented reader. Whereas you, well, you must hate him for abandoning you, right? Don't be ashamed of it. Hatred can be very inspiring. I never liked my own father either."
Maggie turned her head aside when Capricorn finally let go of her chin. Her face was burning with shame and fury, and she could still feel his fingers, as if they had left marks on her skin.
"Did Buster tell you why he was to bring you here so late at night?"
"To meet someone." Maggie tried to make her voice sound bold and unafraid, but she didn't succeed. The sobs in her throat would only let a whisper emerge.
"That's right."
Capricorn gave the magpie a signal. She came down the steps and disappeared into the dark beyond the columns. A little later, there was a creaking sound above Maggie's head, and when she looked up to the roof in alarm, she saw something being lowered from the darkness. A net. No, two nets, such as she had seen in fishing boats. They stopped and hung there about 5 meters above the floor, just over Maggie's head. And only then did she see human figures caught in the coarse ropes, like birds entangled in the netting over a fruit tree. Maggie was feeling dizzy just from looking up. What must it be like to be dangling up there, held only by a few cords?
"Well, don't you recognize your old friend?"
Capricorn put his hands in his dressing gown pockets. Tinkerbell was still held in Buster's fingers like a broken doll. Her faint tinkling was the only sound to be heard.
"Yes, I see you do."
There was no mistaking the satisfaction in Capricorn's voice. "That's what happens to filthy little traitors who steal keys and set prisoners free." Maggie refused to look at Capricorn. She had eyes only for Dustfinger.
"Hello, Maggie. You look rather pale," he called down.
He was trying very hard to sound light-hearted, but Maggie heard the terror in his voice. She knew what voices meant.
"I'm supposed to give you love from your father. He'll come for you soon, he says, and he won't come alone." "You'll make a teller of fairy tales yet if you carry on like that, fire-eater," Buster called up. "But even the girl here doesn't believe that tale. You'll have to think up something better."
Maggie stared up at Dustfinger. She so wanted to believe him.
"Buster, let go of that poor fairy," he called to his old enemy. "Send her up to me. It's far too long since I saw one of those."
Oh, I bet you'd like that. No, I'm keeping her for myself, replied Basta, flicking Tinkerbell's tiny nose with his finger. I've heard that fairies keep bad luck away if you keep them in your house. I'll put her in one of those big glass wine jugs. You were always so keen on fairies. What do they eat? Do I feed her flies or what?
Tinkerbell braced her arms against his fingers and tried desperately to free her second wing. She managed it, too, but Basta had a strong grip on her legs, and hard as she fluttered, she couldn't break free. At last, with a quiet tinkle, she gave up. Her light was hardly any brighter now than a candle flickering out.
"Do you know why I had the girl brought here, Dustfinger?" called Capricorn up to his prisoner. "She was to persuade you to tell us something about her father and where he is, if you really know anything, which I begin to doubt. But now I don't need the information any more. The daughter can take her father's place, and just at the right time, too, for I've decided that we must think up something really special for your punishment, something impressive, something memorable. After all, that's only right for a traitor, isn't it? Can you guess what my idea is? No? Then let me give you a clue. In your honor, my new reader will read aloud to us from Inkheart. It's your favorite book, after all, even though I know you're not very fond of the character I want her to bring out of it. Her father would have fetched that old friend for me long ago if you hadn't helped him to escape. But now his daughter will do it. Can you guess who it is, I mean?
Dustfinger laid his scarred cheek against the net.
Oh, yes, indeed I can. How could I ever forget him?
He said so quietly that Maggie could hardly make out the words.
Why are you talking only about the Fire Eater's punishment? The magpie had appeared between the columns again. Have you forgotten our little mute pigeon, Racer? Her treachery was at least as bad as his.
She looked up at the second net with a disdainful expression.
Yes, to be sure.
There was something almost like regret in Capricorn's voice.
Ah, what a waste. But there's nothing else for it.
Maggie couldn't see the face of the woman dangling in the second net just beyond Dustfinger. She saw only the dark blonde hair, a blue dress, and slender hands clinging to the ropes. Capricorn sighed heavily.
It really is a shame, he said, turning to Dustfinger. Why did you have to pick on her, of all people? Couldn't you have persuaded one of the others to go nosing around for you? I really have had a weakness for her ever since that useless Darius read her out of the book for me. It never bothered me that she lost her voice in the process. No, far from it. I stupidly assumed that meant I could trust her more. Do you know her hair used to look like spun gold?
"Yes, I remember that," said Dustfinger hoarsely. "But in your presence it's turned darker."
"Nonsense!" Capricorn frowned with annoyance. "Maybe we should try fairy dust, sprinkled with a little fairy dust, they say. Even brass will look like gold. Perhaps it works on a woman's hair as well."
"Hardly worth the trouble," said the magpie mockingly, unless she wanted to look particularly beautiful for her execution.
Oh, never mind.
Capricorn turned abruptly and went back to the steps. Maggie hardly noticed. She was looking up at the strange woman. Capricorn's words were working away feverishly in her mind. Hair like spun gold. That useless reader, Darius. No, it couldn't be true. She stared up, narrowing her eyes to see the face better through the ropes, but it was hidden in dark shadows.
Good. Capricorn dropped into his chair again with another heavy sigh. How long will we need for the preparations? It all should be done properly, I think.
2 days,
The magpie climbed the steps and took up her position behind him. If you want to summon them in from the other bases, that is. Capricorn frowned.
Yes, why not? It's time to show everyone a little example. Discipline has left much to be desired recently.
He looked at Buster as he said this, and Buster bowed his head, as if all the misdemeanors of the last few days weighed heavily on him.
The day after tomorrow, then, Capricorn went on, when darkness falls, I want Darius to carry out another experiment with the girl first. Get her to read something out of a book, anything. I just want to make sure that fairy didn't turn up by pure chance.
Buster had wrapped Tinkerbell in his jacket again. Meggie wanted to put her hands over her ears so as not to hear the feeble, tinkling sounds the fairy was making. She pressed her lips together to stop them from trembling, and looked up at Capricorn.
"But I won't read aloud for you," she said. Her voice rang out through the church at twice its usual volume. "Not a word! I won't read you out any treasure, and I certainly won't read out some kind of executioner!"
She spat the word into Capricorn's face. But Capricorn only toyed with the belt of his dressing gown, looking bored.
"Take her away," he told Buster. "It's late. The child must get some sleep."
Buster prodded Meggie in the back.
"You heard. Go on, get moving."
Meggie looked up at Dustfinger one last time, then walked uncertainly down the nave ahead of Buster. When she passed below the second net, she looked up again. The unknown woman's face was still hidden, but she thought she could make out her eyes and a slender nose. And if she imagined the hair somewhat lighter in colour...
"Go on, I said," snapped Buster.
Meggie obeyed, but she kept looking back.
"I won't do it,"
she cried when she had almost reached the church porch.
"I swear I won't read anyone here. Ever."
"Oh, don't swear oaths you can't keep," whispered Buster as he pushed the door open and led her out into the brightly floodlit square.
Chapter 40 The Black Horse of the Night. Fenolio was lying on his bed when Buster pushed Meggie in through the door.
"What have you done to her?" he demanded of Buster, swiftly getting to his feet. "She's white as a sheet."
But Buster had already closed the door behind him.
"You'll be relieved in 2 hours," Meggie heard him tell the guard.
Then he was gone. Fenolio put his hands on Meggie's shoulders and looked in her face with concern.
"Come on, tell me. What do they want you for? Is your father here?"
Meggie shook her head.
"They've caught Dustfinger," she said. "And a woman."
"What woman? Heavens, what a state you're in!"
Fenolio drew her over to the bed, and Meggie sat down beside him.
"I think she's my mother," she whispered.
"Your mother?"
Fenolio looked at her in astonishment. His eyes were bloodshot from his sleepless night. Distractedly, Meggie smoothed down her skirt. It was dirty and crumpled. No wonder she'd been sleeping in it for days.
"Her hair's darker now," she stammered. "And of course, Moe's photo of her is 9 years old. Capricorn has her in a net, and Dustfinger, too. He's going to have them both executed in 2 days' time, and I'm supposed to read someone out of Inkheart to do it. That friend, as Capricorn calls him. I told you. Moe was supposed to be going to do it. You wouldn't tell me who the friend was, but now you must."
She looked pleadingly at Fenolio. The old man closed his eyes.
"Merciful heaven," he murmured.
Outside, it was still dark. The moon hung in the sky in front of their window, with a cloud drifting past it, like a tattered dress.
"I'll tell you tomorrow," said Fenolio. "That's a promise."
"No, tell me now."
He looked at her thoughtfully.
"It's not a story for this hour of the night. You'll have bad dreams afterward."
"Tell me,"
Meggie repeated. Fenolio sighed.
"Oh, dear, I know that look from my grandchildren," he said. "Very well, then."
He helped her up to her bunk, put Mo's sweater under her head, and pulled the blanket up to her chin.
"I'll tell it to you the way I wrote it in Inkheart," he said quietly. "I know that passage almost by heart. I was very proud of it at the time."
He cleared his throat before he began, whispering the words into the night.
"But one